Today, instead of celebrating the triumph of success, we're exploring what happens on the other end of life's spectrum. What do we do when things don't look so good? Our next story comes to us from across the pond. Snap Judgment's Davey Kim spoke with Mark Dowd.
So it's 1992, and I've had a really tough day at work. It's about 10 p.m. in the evening, and I get in, and my flatmate looked to me and said, Mark, I think you better sit down. Now, there's something you need to listen to. He put a bottle of whiskey and a glass next to the answering machine, and I just pressed the play button. And in about 30 seconds, a message was left for me from a relative, a man saying he was my uncle, telling him that my father had died. For 10 minutes, I was just numb. And I had these images of my father passing through my mind, the things I hadn't said to him. I gulped the whiskey, and finally I dialed those numbers, expecting my tearful mother to pick the phone up.
Hello, Swinton 8199.
It was my father.
It's you. Is that our Mark? Are you all right, son? You don't half sound queer.
Well, my dad knew I was gay, but I guess he was using queer in the sense of sounding a bit flummoxed, a bit off balance.
What are you doing? It's 10:45. You don't normally ring this late. Are you in trouble?
No. I thought you... So I went through this pretense conversation for 10 minutes and limply ended up saying that I would call him later in the week. I thought, what was on that answer phone message? My father is not dead, but somebody's dead. But who? So I pressed the play button once more, and the second time round, listened much more intently to the contents of this message. And I picked up this name, Ronnie Craddock, who purported to be my uncle. And I thought to myself, Ronnie Craddock. The last name, Craddock. Ah! And it was like one of those flashbacks in the movies. Suddenly, I'm 18 years old. It's 1979. And at that time, I had a job in a furniture factory, carrying out all sorts of very complicated mechanical jobs, unsealing valves, stripping out bits of machinery. I was paired up with this guy called Bob Craddock. He was an older guy, small, wiry, muscly, divorcee. I understood he actually had a son in a previous relationship. Well, it was pretty clear after a week or two that Bob had taken a bit of a shine to me. He liked beer, I liked beer. I'd found a new friend. So we'd been in the job for 2 or 3 weeks, and then one day in the boiler room, absolutely out of nothing, Bob put the moves on me. He lunged towards me and just kissed me, really passionately. He was a macho, masculine guy, the least likely gay man you can ever imagine in the world. Ever since I'd been 13, 14, I'd been coming to terms with my sexuality, and I'd come out to my parents gently, but never in my wildest dreams did I think that my first serious relationship was going to be with a welder in a furniture factory. He kind of grew on me in the time in that factory. I mean, sure, he was older than me, but, you know, I was 17. I had a fairly difficult relationship with my own father, and here was somebody, well, old enough to be my own father, I guess. This guy had an embrace that was so kind of strong and so unconditional. That's why I think I began to fall in love with this guy. And so we began this intense relationship in the factory, a more dangerous place you can't imagine. For two gay men, we were surrounded by homophobic guys who looked at, you know, semi-naked pictures of women in the British tabloid newspapers. There was a lot of pressure there to conform. Things between us were fine for the first few weeks, but it began to become more and more difficult. I was frightened that everyone would find out, but he was so passionate that he didn't seem to take any of these concerns on board. One day, I just absolutely lost it. I just said to him, look, this has got to stop. And he exploded. We had this huge row in the factory.
So I just flung my overalls on the floor and I said, Bob, stuff you. It's over.
I was out of there, heading to the factory gates, slammed them shut.
I hopped onto this passing bus with some of the other workers from the factory and we sped off.
Peace and quiet at last. This lasted for about 5 minutes until suddenly there was a little jab in my ribs from a woman who I recognised in the factory. And she said, excuse me, love, I don't want to interrupt you, but there's a man in a car behind. I think he's trying to get your attention. And as I turned round at the back of the bus, I saw Bob in his metallic blue Ford Cortina, face practically pressed against the windscreen, driving like the clappers, trying to catch up with the bus. And I thought, oh my God, is there anything this man won't do just to get his own way? Suddenly, all the traffic surrounding the bus came to a halt. Bob had come alongside the bus and blocking all the oncoming traffic, drawing everybody's attention. He leans over to the passenger window and starts shouting out, I love you, I love you, don't let it end like this. Just get off the bloody bus. And of course, all the passengers on the bus were looking at him and thinking, well, who's he talking to? Where is the big Swedish blonde who's the object of his attention? I'm now hiding behind my newspaper with my face burning like a tomato. And suddenly one man turned across sharply from his seat and pointed at me and said, it's him. It's him. It's his mate. Bum chums. They all began to bang on the floor, shouting out these abusive terms. I felt like a caged animal. So I had no choice. I just had to get off this bus, jump straight into the Cortina with Bob, who instantly slams in ABBA. And we just drove off. I said, what have you just done? And he was smiling. That worked, didn't it? We're back together. Worked. I said, what do you mean? You've just outed us to the whole of the factory. What are we going to do tomorrow if we have to go back and work there? We're going to have to face an inquest. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Well, you better get thinking. You know, I hardly slept that night. I thought, how are we going to get over this? What are we going to do? And so at 7:30 the next morning, with a slow paces, I got towards the factory gates and instantly recognised several of the people who'd been on that bus. They were all waiting. I thought, oh, here we go. Here we go. But to my total amazement, they were all smiling. And they all came up and patted me on the back and said, hey, lad, oh, we're so sorry about what happened on the bus. What do you mean? We didn't know. Didn't know what? And they pointed over to Bob, who was about 20 metres away. He just raised his hand in acknowledgement and smiled. About you and your dad?
My dad?
Yeah, well, he got in early. He's been telling us all. I mean, we knew he was divorced, and we knew he had a son, but we didn't know it was you. Well, it all makes sense now, doesn't it? I mean, all that I love you stuff from his car. I mean, you know, sorry, we thought you were a couple of, you know, them. I looked at Bob and there was a smart look. And I strode over to him and said, what's all this about? Dad? Well, you knew I've got a lad, don't you? Well, I think you did mention that, but it's not me. Well, it is now. Flash forward 13 years, back to the present, back to that voicemail message that had been left. That voice was from Ronnie Craddock. That was Bob's brother. I had no contact with Bob since we broke up 10, 11 years ago. It was a really messy, rather sour affair between us. And yet here he was, his brother, telling me that he was dead. Bob must have been in his 50s. I'd ring up Ronnie, the brother.
Oh, lad, we've not seen you since you were 2 or 3. Not since your dad went off and broke up with your mother. Oh, listen, he said, I've been planning this funeral for Bob for Friday. For your dad. You won't be coming, won't you?
Well, hang on a minute. I'm not Bob's son. I'm just a really good friend. And,
No, you must be. When he died, we went to his flat. we found all the photos of the two of you on vacation together. I mean, everybody's got those photos. We found all your newspaper articles. He recorded all your television documentaries. He never stopped talking about you.
And all of a sudden, I just felt really guilty. I thought, you know, I couldn't reciprocate these feelings. This guy held me in his heart for all this time, and I almost felt as though I'd let him down. Now, at this stage, I could have outed Bob to his family, but he'd spent the whole of his life keeping this back from his family. Here was his brother grieving for the loss of Bob. I mean, who was I to put the cat amongst the pigeons at this point? And he got very serious and said,
"Look, I don't want my brother coming across as a liar. Think about it. There's an expectation that at least with Bob's death, we'll finally get to see his long-lost son. If you don't come, there's going to be a huge disappointment around here. You have to come."
So I took a long gulp and I said,
"Well, if it's just for this Friday, the funeral."
So the night before the funeral, I'm staying in Manchester where my parents live, and my dad says to me, "What are you doing in Manchester? There was that funny phone call the other night, and now, a few days later, you're here. What's going on?" "Well, it's a bit sad, really. I've got to go to a funeral tomorrow." "Well, who's died?" "Well, you won't remember him. He was a man I worked with in a furniture factory." "Oh," he said, "I remember that. He was the man who taught you to drive, wasn't it? Bob." "Yeah, yeah." "Oh, dear," he said. Well, where's the funeral?"
"Just south of Manchester."
"Oh, well, listen," he said, "I'm not doing anything. I'll come with you tomorrow for a bit of company." Can you imagine the prospect of my fake father in a coffin and my real father sitting next to me having absolutely no idea about the nature of this relationship? And I tried for the next few hours to persuade my father not to come. "No, absolutely not. When a man dies, you've got to pay your respects. That man was good to you. The least we can do is give him a good send-off. No, I'll be coming with you." The fact of the matter is, my dad knew I was gay. Fine. It's another thing for me to be having a relationship with a man who's passing himself off as my father. It would have wounded him. There would have been silence for days and days, and that's not something I could risk happening. So the morning of the funeral comes, and the first thing I do is I recruit my younger brother. He knows everything about my backstory. He's going to be the chaperone to my father. We get to the church and look round and saw that the seats at the front had been left vacant. And then Ronnie, Bob's brother, gently grabbed me by the arm and beckoning towards the seats at the front where the family would normally sit. And my father was looking at me very puzzled and blurted out, "What are we doing here? We're not the family." One or two people stared at him and I thought, "Oh, get me out of here." And just in the nick of time, a voice from the front, it was the priest, "Please open your hymnals. Let's sing Lord of All Hopefulness." The service itself is fine. Ronnie does a really nice, sincere tribute. But then the horror of the reception, where potentially it could all unravel. There's beer, there's wine, there's an opportunity for people to talk to one another spontaneously. So I turned to my father and I said, "Well, I think you better be getting away now." And he looked at me and said, "Hang on a minute, I'm feeling a bit peckish. Come on." He invited himself to the reception. The reception, it's completely weird. Even though it wasn't obvious to other people, we had all the welders, all the people who I remember from 12, 13 years ago. And then, on the right, a few members of Manchester's gay community, one or two drag queens, very soberly and respectfully attired. This was the schizophrenia, if you like, of Bob's life. By day, he was a macho welder, but by night, he was Bacardi Bob. People who I don't recognise, who I've never met before in my life, so suddenly coming up to me and saying, "Oh, it's such a tragedy." He was very proud. He brought the photos around to our house, you know, one day. He told us all about your trip to Vienna. Well, you just smile and you move on. Then out of the corner of my eye, I suddenly see two aunts suddenly coming towards me. They step forward. One of them puts their arm on mine and says, "You know, love, we were only saying to one another in the church."
"What?"
"You do have your dad's eyes." And out of nowhere, the voice of my father.
"Oh, thank you very much."
And they stared at him as thinking, "Who's that?" They looked back for me to reassurance. And I shrugged my shoulders. Suddenly my father is pulled out of my grasp by my brother, who's then lurching him across to the other side of the room. Somehow we get through this reception. My brother and father go off in one car. I make my own way home. And in that journey back, I've got Bob's face and his voice right there with me. Recollections, the time we had together in the factory, the fun we had, the rows we had, those weird trips we made in his Mark III rusty blue Cortina. And how weird to think that this man, even though he's 6 feet under, is still exercising a huge influence, holding presence on my life. Many, many years later, I decided to write a screenplay, a film based on this story, and I changed the names of some of the characters, but the outline of the story was fairly clear. Maybe it was time to tell my father, honestly, who Bob really was. A few days after I had sent him the script in the post, I nervously ring home. I'm expecting my father to have understood the whole thing.
"I've read your script. I was saying to your mother, I don't really get this story."
Suddenly the phone was seized by my mother.
"Oh, your dad. I've read it. I know all about this. It's pure black comedy, isn't it? But he'll never get it. He just doesn't want to see it."
And that, I think, was his choice. He was staying inside a closet. And I guess that also includes me too. I never completely came out about this whole thing with my father. I just let sleeping dogs lie.
Big thanks to Mark Dowd for sharing your story with The Snap. We'll have a link to his article in The Guardian about this very story on our website, snapjudgment.org.